The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 11th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. We look at the future and tour part of the past of Northwest Arkansas on today's show. In about 90 seconds, an updated strategy from the Northwest Arkansas Council to push the region further. And later, an old building gets an old look. After decades, a facade on the Fayetteville Square is coming off and revealing an original exterior. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek takes us inside and out. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, right after Ozarks at Large on NPR's Here and Now, after the Vietnam War, thousands of war babies were left behind. They were the children of American servicemen and Vietnamese women. Now, one man is trying to find them and reunite them with their families. A conversation with him about his mission and the day's news on Here and Now in about an hour on 91.3. A blood drive to help replenish summer supplies continues this afternoon until 3:30 at the Job Path Classroom at 203 North College in Fayetteville. Appointments for giving blood can always be made by calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. And if you're seeking some outdoors time this afternoon, a guided hike to Yellow Rock will begin at 4 this afternoon at the Yellow Rock Trailhead near Camp Area A in Devil's Den. Mistina, a park interpreter, will lead the way for free. It's about 7 minutes afternoon, and we begin this Ozarks at Large with consideration of the future. Yesterday, the Northwest Arkansas Council issued its annual report. The council revealed an updated report on the economic health of the region and an updated blueprint for improvement. The two-part update, according to Nelson Peacock, the president and CEO of the council, is that the region is doing well and has room for getting better.
That's right. I mean, that's what the strategy's all about, is aspiring and doing the work to be one of the best regions in the world. And that's what our members want. It's what people in the region want. And so these are the steps we think that we need to take to get there.
Those steps are outlined in a 37-page development strategy that authors say is intended to help the council and the region target transformational innovation. And those steps, authors say, build on advances made in the last 3 years. Since 2015, the report lists a reduction in unemployment from 4.2% to 2.7%, an 8.5% increase in the average annual wage from just under $46,000 a year to just under $50,000, and an uptick in the percentage of residents with a bachelor's degree or higher from just under 30% 3 years ago to just over 31% right now. But Ted Abernathy, who helped compile the report, says for the region to continue to grow, there has to be more work. He's with the group Economic Leadership LLC. He says one of the most obvious areas of improvements is in middle skills training, skills that require more than a high school degree, but not a college diploma.
A little over half the jobs in America are middle skill jobs. And right now, we don't have half the people with middle skill credentials. And so locally here, you've got a big gap. When we talk to employers, there are job openings everywhere that pay pretty good wages for machinists, for welders, for HVAC, for truck drivers, all of those places that need specialized skills but don't need a four-year college degree. The capacity here is at the community college and at NTI, and how do we make those able to have the world-class nature that the region wants to project?
Abernathy says hitting goals set for middle skills opportunities takes public policy choices and some financial investment. Financial investment is also part of an action plan in the new report regarding research and development at the University of Arkansas. The plan calls for doubling the amount of financial investment for research at the U of A. Abernathy explains the amount spent here, about $145 million in 2016, pales when compared to universities in peer regions. In the Research Triangle in North Carolina, for example, the combined spending at Duke University, the University of North Carolina, and North Carolina State for research is about $2.5 billion. The new report lists the state of Arkansas as 49th in the country in this category. University of Arkansas Chancellor Joseph Steinmetz says the ability to double the investment at the U of A does exist.
Yeah, I think it's a real possibility. I think we've been underperforming in research, and I compare ourselves to like schools with the same number of faculty and the same distribution of having an engineering college and some strong STEM fields that we should be able to do it. What we don't have is a medical center. And so a lot of dollars that come in are related to health research, but there's no reason that we can't do that kind of research on this campus as well. So I'm very optimistic.
The updated plan for increasing research and development funding at the university calls for a combination of increased federal grant support, business support, and state funding. Ted Abernathy says research funding is a critical driving economic factor and can be a determiner when it comes to attracting and retaining talent for jobs. Chancellor Steinmetz says he sees movement in the right direction. Last year, 9 members of the university faculty were awarded National Science Foundation Early Career Awards for between $500,000 and $850,000.
Well, so what that means is that we're making the right decisions on the talent that we're bringing here as faculty members. So we need that talent, actually, to write proposals that are successful for funding. And so what it means to me is that our colleges and our departments within those colleges are doing a great job hiring the right people.
And Chancellor Steinmetz says expanding money placed into research at the University of Arkansas can reverberate across the state.
It doesn't necessarily only have to be about Northwest Arkansas. In fact, I think we're very sensitive also to the developments that are going on in other places of the state. In fact, one of our main things that we want to accomplish is make sure that the university is a resource everywhere. So I think when they look up here and see what's happening, it's a message that can be delivered to the whole state.
And that dovetails into another call for action included in the new blueprint: better branding of the region as an attractive location for businesses, families, and young, talented workforce. Ted Abernathy, who led the research for the new report, says it takes hard work for a landlocked region in a traditionally poor state to emerge onto a national or global stage.
People on the coast don't know anything but the coast. A few places break out of that a little bit. Maybe Nashville breaks out a little, or the Research Triangle, certainly Austin recently. But Northwest Arkansas Hill has a ways to go. And the branding's not just so you'll feel good about yourself. The branding is so that that young, smart kid growing up in, you know, Phoenix or growing up in upstate New York, when they're considering where they want to bring their talents, where they want to work, where they want to grow their family, one of the places they think about is Northwest Arkansas. So you're branding in order to attract the talent you need to fuel the company growth that's going to sustain you.
Along with the calls for improvement in the report are signs of success. In 2011, the Northwest Arkansas Council identified 5 other metros as peers: Kansas City, Omaha, Knoxville, Tulsa, and Huntsville, Alabama. 7 years later, Northwest Arkansas ranks better than each of those cities in several categories, including economic strength, future inertia, and talent. Now the council is using a new set of peers: Raleigh, North Carolina, Provo, Utah, Madison, Wisconsin, Des Moines, and the ubiquitous Austin, Texas. Northwest Arkansas slides into the middle of that group in most categories, but is 5th out of 6 when it comes to workforce talent and innovation and entrepreneurship. Speakers yesterday stressed the region will need to address housing availability and costs in the near future. And Nelson Peacock, president and CEO of the Northwest Arkansas Council, says the organization continues to attempt to find funding for completion of I-49 crossing the Arkansas-Missouri border and continues to try to attract a low-cost carrier to Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport. He says the annual report shows great advances over the past several years, but he says resting is not an option.
Well, I think we need to educate a lot of people about the plan, why we think we need to do it, and why we need to make these investments to strive even further. In a time and a place where everything seems to be going well, you know, we need to convince people that we need to look 5 years beyond to set ourselves up for success in the future. That's what the leaders did a generation ago, and so that's what we need to do now.
At least in the very near future, it appears the area will continue to be one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. Just since 2015, the population has increased by 9% to over 537,000 people. That's a growth rate more than 6 times the rate of the rest of Arkansas. You can find out much more about the Northwest Arkansas Council strategy by following a link at ozarksatlarge.com or by inspecting the website nwacouncil.org. And ahead on today's show, a great music week begins tonight with Jenny Lewis at George's Majestic Lounge and includes free shows at Gully Park, the Fayetteville Public Library, and elsewhere. Free and slightly more than free chances to see and hear great live music outlined with Timothy Dennis ahead on this Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large. The Fort Smith Symphony announces its 2018-2019 concert season opening Sunday, September 9th, featuring world-renowned baritone Jubilant Sykes performing music by Copland and American Spirituals. Other concerts include Time for Three, Charlie Chaplin's City Lights with orchestra, and more. Season tickets are now available at fortsmithsymphony.org. Eureka Springs and Fat Tire Bike Shop welcome the 20th annual Eureka Springs Fat Tire Festival, July 13th through the 15th. This three-day weekend offers competitive mountain bike racing in the downhill, super D, short track, and cross-country disciplines, plus non-competitive groups rides. Spectators are admitted free. FATtirefestival.com for registration and for more information.
July is National Ice Cream Month. Yes, I scream, you scream, we all scream when the news gets out of control. All Things Considered helps keep things in perspective with news and sprinkles of the lighter stuff.
More pickle.
Ooh, I've got some of the pastry on my microphone.
Listen to All Things Considered for news and scoops that are a little sweeter. Hear the bigger picture every afternoon.
Every weekday at 3 on 91.3. If you were born in the Fayetteville area after 1958, there's a good chance you have no idea what the First National Bank building on the downtown square actually looked like until right now. That modern facade, the gray metal slats, the turquoise geometric squares, all coming down. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us about how the building's past is going to shape its future.
That's the sound of construction crews uncovering a piece of history on the corner of Block and Center on the Fayetteville Square. We started getting glimpses of the building's original 1898 exterior a couple weeks ago as the metal panels and screens from 1958 started coming down.
You know, we didn't know any of the history. We didn't know anything that was behind the building until we actually got in there and started looking behind the screens and we're like, oh, this old stone is still here. The old exterior of the building was still here, which we had no clue of.
That's Aaron Crawley. He's the new part owner of the property. He says at first, taking down the facade wasn't something that crossed he and his partner's minds.
At the time, we didn't know that it was even there, you know, all the stonework and everything was as elaborate as it is. We didn't know if it was all intact.
After that, though, Crawley says the decision to take down the paneling was easy.
So it was originally three buildings. So that was a surprise at first that it was originally three buildings, you know, built in late 1800s.
Crawley says they brought in Lisa and Albert Skiles as architects and then turned to local publications, the Shiloh Museum, in the University of Arkansas Special Collections, to start piecing together the history of the buildings. Here's Lisa Skiles.
So one of the things that Rachel at Shiloh Museum did was put together all the Sanborn maps for us so we could see the morphology of this corner. And so then we're able to look at 1904 and see that this north building on Block Street had been added. And then we're able to jump forward to 1908 and then see that the east building was added.
Sanborn Maps was a publisher in the 19th and 20th centuries that created maps for fire insurance companies. Lisa says the maps also show what kind of businesses were located in the buildings over the years.
It had very other uses. Drugstore, one of them was a seed store, hardware, we had barbershops, we had printers in this little north building.
Crawley says they also went digging for photos of the square taken before 1958.
A lot of them was from like U of A archives when they would have homecoming parades and you'd get to see the pictures and some of the advertising on there that showed who were the tenants at that time.
As more and more of the building was revealed, Crawley says the most striking features are the arches along Block and Center Streets.
These arches, they used to have entries from Block. So that was the thing that was most exciting to us, is that we could bring back hopefully some of that pedestrian-friendly downtown feel on Block Street.
Crawley says they're also hoping to reconstruct the original windows and a stairwell that had once been on the Block Street side of the building.
That bay right there with the arch, you can see there's a window in on the floor line. So we've determined that that was an old stairwell that went through, that went all the way to the top. So that's going to be exciting to be, hopefully bring back that stairwell so we can access all the floors from Block.
Architect Albert Skiles says this is a rare opportunity to bring back architecture that marked a very particular time in Fayetteville's history.
If you look around and see the Easton building over here and the courthouse and the jail, they were all done in the similar fashion in the same time period. It's called Richardsonian Romanesque, named after an architect in Boston that started to do this style with institutional buildings.
Albert says putting up facades like the one they're taking down came into vogue in the mid-1900s.
This screen was typical of a lot of towns in America, in Arkansas as well, where downtown areas in the 50s and 60s wanted to cover up their old buildings. And this is done everywhere. Here they did it in spades. So they made it really tough. You know, it wasn't just a fake thing. It was meant to be forever.
And Lisa adds, at the time, it also made sense for a business like a bank.
Form follows function. The bank wanted to look secure. They wanted to look modern. They had disparate facades, right? So the architect, T. Ewing Sheldon, was unifying the look. He was providing a sense of permanence and solidness and not very porous, right? So you had all these openings. They covered those up, and it was very appropriate for that time and place, and it was very well done.
Albert says the bank even removed the original 8x8 windows that ended up under the new facade.
Except you can see there they put little windows in, and if you see the outline of their the cheap little window, you can see that block around it. That's the real window. They made it tough on us. I was hoping the windows would still be in there. But the plan now is to take that block out and put in the real windows.
Other pieces of the original building have also disappeared over time. There had once been a pointed tower on the corner of Center and Block, but the top of it had been removed. And then Albert says there were the loggias along Center Street.
This front was once an arcade where you could walk under these arches. So this is a very prominent part of the building facade that is facing the square.
Albert says they're hoping they can bring all that back.
Yeah, we're going to try to put this all back the way it looks.
But before they can do that, crews have to take everything else down. That task was taken up by contractor Dan Minkle.
If you look at modern buildings, lots of times you'll see a crack in the masonry. These old buildings were so well built that you don't see cracks anywhere. Nothing is separated, nothing has opened up. Everything's still square and true. It's not leaning in one direction.
Minkle says his crew is almost done taking off the metal paneling and screens along the top portion of the building.
The screen on one side, it was pop riveted. On the other side, it was screwed. So even though it's done at the same time, we found two different processes. The drivet we're taking off on the corner, we're not sure what we've got because, again, that used to be granite all the way up. And we just started this morning uncovering that, and it's different than we expected. And then the clock on the corner, we're not sure yet whether they had to bust some of the stone out in order to put steel in to support it, and we won't know until we uncover it.
And while a lot of this is going on outside, Lisa and Albert Skiles say exploring and tearing down portions of the interior of the building have been crucial to their understanding of what they're seeing on the exterior.
So we can take you to the second floor and see where one of the exploration began before the facade came off.
We follow Aaron Crawley through what had once been First National Bank offices.
So this wall, which you can see, so this was the wall in between the two buildings. So they opened it up, and then we started kind of pulling some stuff off, we found an old fire door that was stuck into the wall.
We walk further down the hallway to a room where the walls had been peeled back to reveal the brick we saw from the outside. Albert Skiles explains what they were looking for.
We knew where we were because I said, let's just tear this wall up first and see what happens. And then slowly this starts to happen, you know. And then we all just go, wow, aha, there it is. And so these three little arches are really particular. This bay is unique to the whole system because it was made at the end and it's different size. It has different fenestration. And we knew that there's a big arch right here in the middle of this floor. So we knew this is where the stairwell was. So we said, let's pull this carpet back. And then bingo, it's right there. See, there's old floor, there's plywood. And so we measured this and it's 16 by 16. That's a big stairwell.
Albert says they've also worked their way up through the rafters, which revealed 16-foot ceilings that over time had been brought down to 8 feet. They'll also be looking at the walls to figure out which of them are supporting the structure and which are merely there for partition purposes. Crawley also gave us a tour of the basement.
So we're under the sidewalk now, right? But this is what they call the snorkel room, and it goes up from the sidewalk. I think it was you would make a deposit down, and they could send it back up through there.
The snorkel room, Crawley says, was a kind of precursor to the ATM.
So there's some kind of pulley system. We've got the model number, Diebold model number, so we're trying to date it that way. But we were told by the previous owner that this was one of the first drive-throughs west of the Mississippi.
The bottom portion of the snorkel machine is still in the basement. The top half that would have come out of the ground above us to allow customers to make deposits and withdrawals is long gone. Everyone involved in the project says for now they're focusing on discovering what else they can find in the original building. They'll start making renovation plans after that, and Albert Skiles says the community can help them out.
One thing while I'm thinking about it, too, we want to ask your listeners, the radio family out there, if anybody's got any pictures of this building in their scrapbooks or anything, let us know, because we could use anything we could get.
The contractor says we should be able to see the building's exterior in its entirety in about 2 to 3 weeks. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
The First National Bank building isn't the only one on the square that has received a modern facade update. The Easton building that's across from it on Block Street also once had been covered up. That facade was removed several decades ago. This is Ozarks at Large. Vega, originally from West Texas, takes photographs and teaches photography. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, Vega, who relocated to Eureka Springs several years ago, refers to himself as a photo artist.
Eli Vega is proud of his cultural roots. He is third generation Mexican American.
I was born in a railroad boxcar. My parents were migrant workers, and they traveled between Texas and all the way up to Wyoming. And had decided to stay there for a couple of years to work in the wintertime. That's where I was born. They were poor, so my dad worked for a variety of employers, but one of them was Burlington, you know, railroad company. And so Burlington had a lot of helpers, like my dad, and they had built and sort of renovated these boxcars for people to live in. If you can imagine. So that's where my family lived, in one of these boxcars, and that's where I was born.
With the support of his family, Vega attended Texas Tech University studying art, but instead spent much of his life working in the corporate sector until he took his leave finally in 2010 at the age of 63 to pursue his passion, photography, settling first in Colorado, then Eureka Springs, an artist's colony, in 2016.
So I don't think like a photographer, that might sound strange. I should say I don't think like the typical photographer, which takes pictures. You aim the camera somewhere, you click, and nowadays you go to the computer and see what you can do in Photoshop with it. With me is, I don't want to create my art in my computer. I just want to use my computer to fine-tune my art. So I try to create it as much as possible in camera.
Vega uses his digital Nikon camera as if it were a paintbrush, creating beautiful impressionistic photographs of urban and landscapes. He points to one of his better-known works hanging above his fireplace in his home in Uptown Eureka, a 16 by 22 color print.
Which I call Watercolor Willows. And when people see it, they often ask me two questions. Is this a painting? I said, no, it's a photograph. The next question is, you photoshopped this, right? I said, no, I didn't photoshop this. I created this in camera. And then they asked me, how could you possibly do that, something like that, in camera? And to me, it's simple. It's a feature in the camera called a multiple exposure feature, which a lot of people don't use today because it gives them art and they're looking for a picture, for a photograph. And for me, it's like, it's my go-to tool to create my artistic, impressionistic photography.
He says multiple exposures allows the photographer to blend two images in camera. The first photograph is slightly out of focus, the second in focus.
And when you combine the out-of-focus image with the in-focus image, you get watercolor willows. This impressionistic feel to the photograph, which you look at it and it has a sense of movement, a lot of color, but when you look at it, it almost vibrates, you know, you can, especially with the right lighting. And that's impressionism.
Vega's second passion is teaching his method to amateur and professional photographers, hosting workshops in Rocky Mountain National Park, Garden of the Gods in Colorado, Eureka Springs School of the Art. He also teaches community college courses, one coming up at North Arkansas College in Harrison, June 30th. And later this summer, he'll be traveling and teaching in Colorado. But Vega also publishes a full-color photography book detailing his method.
It's called Right Brain Photography, parenthetical, Be an Artist First.
Similar to the best-selling series Drawing from the Right Side of the Brain, first published in 1979 by art teacher Betty Edward, science reveals the left portion of the brain governs verbal and rational perception and expression, the right side, nonverbal sense perceptions and intuition.
I even have a left brain chapter in here. I throw in a left brain chapter just for those who want to know, what about f-stops and shutter speeds and exposure modes?
Vega takes his students outdoors on photographic expeditions, teaching them how to use a camera to make art.
The term photography, just the word photography, the etymology of photography, the origins of the word photography, comes from an old Greek word that means painting with light.
You can view Vega's work, which has been widely published across the Mid-South, he says, online at elivega.net. You can also follow him on Facebook, where he schedules workshops, as well as private lessons. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Eli Vega recently curated a national photography exhibit during Eureka Springs May Festival of the Arts. He invites listeners to view the winners at a link we've posted at ozarksatlarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. 91.3 is supported by Arkansas Children's Northwest, providing fast access to pediatric experts specializing in kid-size care. Arkansas Children's Northwest is located in Springdale, across from Arvest Ballpark. Information at archildrens.org/emergency.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On tomorrow's edition of Ozarks, Philip Moore is a water quality researcher. He says the Mulberry River is in trouble.
The river is getting more acid, and this really stunned me because I thought of the Mulberry as the most pristine river in Arkansas.
A report on the Mulberry on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. If you can't be with us at noon or 7, don't forget there is a free podcast of Ozarks at Large. Our podcast edition can be subscribed to through services like iTunes, Stitcher, Apple TV, and others. And you can always go back and listen to past shows, individual stories, and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. Arkansans qualifying for medical marijuana may be just a bit closer to using it after the Arkansas Supreme Court formally lifted an injunction that had stalled the process. A Pulaski County court had halted the awarding of cultivation licenses. The lower court had ruled that the Medical Marijuana Commission's process of scoring applications was null and void. The state Supreme Court had overruled that decision last month and then formally lifted the injunction yesterday. Five startups have been awarded the licenses. However, companies not part of the original five licensees have, at times, indicated they might seek other legal means to challenge that process. Governor Asa Hutchinson is sounding the alarm, saying trade skirmishes cannot be allowed to turn into full-blown trade wars. Speaking to the Rotary Club of Little Rock yesterday, the governor says tariff maneuvering, led by the White House, is threatening the state's economy. But he says he's optimistic tensions won't manifest into worst-case scenarios. Governor Hutchinson says he believes President Trump has good intentions to address trade imbalances, but he wants to de-escalate tariff talks.
On trade, it's not my position, and I'm very frank with him about that. I've got to fight for Arkansas on that issue and continue to do so. But I'm still optimistic that we're going to land okay on it. We just got to work with them.
The governor notes the state's number one commodity, soybeans, could face a 25% tariff, which some analysts predict could drop Arkansas exports by one-third. The governor says relationships between the state and foreign nations could help soften the blow of the trade bluster that's coming out of the national level. Sales tax collections in Fort Smith this year are almost now on par with collections from 2017. Talk Business and Politics reports the city's sales tax revenues for May totaled more than $3.4 million. And for the year, collections are about $150,000 within the total collected through the same period last year. The Arkansas Scholarship Lottery is reporting a record-breaking year. The lottery's fiscal year ended June 30th, and sales almost reached $500 million. Revenues were just over $500 million. The director of the lottery, Bishop Woolsey, says the best part of the records is being able to provide more scholarship money for Arkansas students. Instant lottery tickets accounted for more than $407 million in sales for the just-completed fiscal year. The Arkansas Razorback volleyball schedule is final. The University of Arkansas Athletic Department released the list of matches yesterday afternoon, and the season begins with an exhibition match against Oklahoma on the road August 18th. The first home match of the official season is Friday, August 24th, against Kansas in Barnhill Arena. In all, there will be 13 home matches in the fall. And to our west, an honor for singer and songwriter John Mellencamp. The Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa announced this morning that Mellencamp is the fifth recipient of the Woody Guthrie Prize. The honor will be awarded August 30th at the center, the day before a special exhibit titled Mellencamp opens. Previous winners of the award include Norman Lear, Chris Christopherson, Mavis Staples, and Pete Seeger.
Support for KUAF comes from contributing listeners and from KUAF's sustaining members. Monthly sustainers of KUAF form a strong foundation, providing reliable and steady support for the programs, salaries, technology, and more that's needed to make this public radio station strong. Thank you to the more than 1,000 sustaining members of 91.3. We appreciate your support.
This is Ozarks at Large. I've moved next door to the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio where Timothy Dennis resides. It's Wednesday, time to talk about all the music in front of us. Timothy, how are you?
I am fantastic. It's been a while.
Well, to listeners, not really, because you've been here the last 2 weeks, but
right. You
were on vacation. We recorded those early. We can tell you that this one's being recorded right now.
Right now. Okay, so let's start with tonight.
All right.
Jenny Lewis is going to be at George's in Fayetteville. Baby.
You know, I saw her when she was at George's several years ago with Bright Eyes.
Oh, wow.
Is Bright Eyes still around?
I don't know.
Does he still play? Connor Oberst, right?
Yeah,
that
he
was
plays
his real name.
Solo, though.
Okay. Well, anyway, she was fantastic that night, and I'm sure she'll be fantastic tonight.
The show tonight, that's going to be a $30 show. It goes until 11:30. I believe it starts at 8:30.
Check for tickets.
Checks
I mean,
for,
I don't know if it's sold out or not,
right.
But she's
when
a big
I
draw.
When I checked a few days ago, it was still not sold out, but definitely check before you go. Let's move on to tomorrow night. The Goley Park concert series continues.
Yes.
The Mighty Pines are this week's entertainment.
Tell me about the Mighty Pines.
So the Mighty Pines, they're kind of a soul-inspired jamgrass quartet from St. Louis. They've got amazing harmonies, though.
Okay.
Amazing vocal harmonies.
York City to Madrid. Took a train all the way to Seville. I spent 3 days in the hotel.
As it is part of the Goalie Park Summer Concert Series, it is a free show, and it's from 7 to 9 p.m. Friday night, there's a lot going on. Let's start down here in Fayetteville. There's going to be a show at Backspace featuring two bands I've had in the studio within the past few months, and then one I have not. Mm-hmm. Magnolia and John Charles are on the bill, as is Cary, Illinois. Cary, Illinois is an indie pop band from Austin, and they're good stuff.
Cary as in C-A-R-R-Y?
Yes.
Okay.
And Illinois as the state.
Well, I figured, yes.
And also at that show, Magnolia is actually debuting a full band.
Oh.
For the first gig, so okay. It should be interesting. That's a $5 show at Backspace. It's from 9 p.m. to about midnight. Also Friday night, Aaron Cam and the One Drops are going to be at George's in Fayetteville.
It's so untrue. I sure have told you about before. There's something more. I'm in love with you.
The One Drops, they're a St. Louis-based band that mixes roots, reggae, soul, and blues, and all of that rock and roll. And they're also going to be joined on that bill by Henaroso from Tulsa.
Nah.
That's a $10 show that begins at 9:30 p.m., again at George's in Fayetteville. Over in Eureka Springs, Adam Cunningham and the Wilson Brothers Band will be at The Odd. If you recognize the name Adam Cunningham, it's because he was a contestant on season 13 of The Voice.
The Voice has had 13 seasons?
I know, right?
Wow. Wow. Okay.
But both he and the Wilson Brothers Band, they kind of play toward the country music end of the Americana spectrum. Mm-hmm. That show at The Odd is $20, and it will be from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m.
Okay.
Still in Eureka Springs, Brian Martin is going to be at Brews.
If all of the roads go the same direction, all of the signs give the same reflection, why do we sit here alone? If the stars in the skies of our eyes are crying, and everything alive is slowly dying, what's
Brian Martin, he's 1/4 of Sad Daddy. His solo stuff showcases his unique fingerpicking on guitar and his sometimes dark and humorous lyrics.
So he does sing as well?
Yes, he does. Okay. He does. That show is from 7 to 10 p.m. Also, finally, Friday night, Still on the Hill will be at Ozark Folkways in Winslow.
Oh.
They're performing their Still a River show, so a lot of songs about the Buffalo River. That's a free show from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m.
Okay.
Moving on to Saturday night, I know you had a story from Robert Ginsburg about this yesterday on Ozarks.
Pat Bianchi.
Pat Bianchi is going to be at Sunrise Stage in Fayetteville.
Which just seemed like a great venue. I mean, he's got the Hammond B3 organ. Mm-hmm. I love Sunrise Stage. Should be a good time. Still some tickets left, I believe.
Right. Still a few, but definitely check before you go. They are $30 at digjazz.com. That show will be from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Also in Fayetteville, the Little Buffalo River Band will be at Kingfish.
Feels just like it should. I never really ever understood what it's like to feel this good. I'm feeling good.
The Little Little Buffalo River Band.
Yeah, they're a rock, blues, and bluegrass band from Jasper, Newton County.
Hmm. Okay.
That show is from 9 p.m. to midnight. Still on Saturday night, but up in Bentonville, yeah. Liverpool Legends will be at Crystal Bridges in Bentonville.
Yeah, what I'm assuming is that they do some Beatles
Yeah,
material.
They're a Branson-based Beatles tribute band. Okay. And I mean, they look the part, they play the part.
Well, when you say they look the part, so I'm guessing early Beatles.
Yeah, the mop tops, kind
not
of
the Sergeant Pepper era.
No, okay. Not the right. Zoot Suits or right. Not Zoot Suits, but marching band outfits.
Right.
No, like very little color in their outfits.
Gotcha.
That is at Crystal Bridges. It's part of the Forest Music Series. So admission's $10, but it's free for members and youths under 18 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
That show will be 7 to 10 p.m. And then finally, Saturday night, Adam Fawcett and the Tallgrass will be at Bike Rack Brewing in Bentonville.
Hell, it's been on the darker end of the dead to come to a dawn.
According to his Facebook page, this might be your last chance to see him in this area a while. He's
oh,
going to
really?
Be in Nashville, I think Washington State. He's going to some other places, according to the Facebook page I saw.
Okay, so don't miss out.
Yeah.
That is a free show, even.
Ah.
It's from 7 to 9 p.m. again at Bike Rack in Bentonville.
That's at the 8th Street Market.
Yes, yeah. That's correct. And then finally, Sunday, East of Zion is going to be at Fayetteville Public Library as part of the Mountain Street Stage Summer Concert Series.
They're always fun.
They're really fun. They're a family string band from here in Fayetteville. And it's a free show with air conditioning included.
So there are plenty of things you can pay money for, and, mm-hmm. and deservedly so. Janet Jackson, Jenny Lewis, those things. But you got the Gully Park, which is mm-hmm. free. You got Adam Fawcett that's free.
You've usually got, Kingfish is free.
Right, and then you're free over there at the library on Sunday, mm-hmm. so you can mix it up.
There's a lot of choices this weekend.
Thank you, Timothy.
Thank you, Kyle.
The saga of expanded Medicaid coverage for Arkansas continues to unfold. It has had a pair of governor's fingerprints on it, several editions of the state legislature tweak it, and even different names. Now, this summer, new requirements have gone into effect. John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, both think the conversation isn't over yet in the state. Roby brought up the latest surrounding Arkansas Works with John Brummett this week.
Medicaid work requirements
yes.
in the headlines this past week. You've been writing about it, number one, but number two, the deadline approached, as well as there was a ruling in Kentucky mm-hmm. that may throw some question marks around the Arkansas Works work requirement there. Tell me what you, to explain to me your position on it at this point in time.
Well, I have a couple of positions, but the general position is that Medicaid is not suitable for welfare-to-work policy, which is what the state is trying to do here. I know why Asa Hutchinson is advancing it, promising these very conservative Republican legislators that we're going to make these people work, is how he managed to pass Medicaid expansion and keep Arkansas Works alive. But Medicaid exists for people who are so poor they simply can't get health care. And to impose a work requirement means that you are saying that if you don't work, or in this case, click on a computer to say you're looking for work, then what's the penalty? You're not going to have health care. We give prisoners on death row health care. The
there
idea
are a
that
lot of exemptions, though, for people
there
in,
are,
in
they
this.
They do carve out a lot of exemptions, and they should. I mean, if you've got dependent children at home, if you're the sole provider, if you've got any sort of medical condition, this is for able-bodied people. But the ruling in Kentucky beat us in getting a waiver for Medicaid expansion. We were second. We're the first to implement it. The ruling there basically said Medicare is not the purpose of Medicare.
Medicaid.
The purpose of Medicaid is to provide, expand health care to those who need it. Inserting a work requirement into it defies the very purpose and concept of it because the penalty is overly harsh. The people who brought the case in Kentucky, they're now looking at Arkansas. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to come in here and make the same case. So that's my position. My other position is, as I said, this is, when you look at this program, it's less a work requirement than a web proficiency requirement. There's a Human Services Department has put out a nice YouTube video. It's as well done as our weekly sessions here, at least. But basically, the spokesman for Human Services is saying, now, if you're out there and you're 30 to 49 and you're so poor you don't have a computer, please click here, then click here, then enroll here by filling in all this. And the deadline for the first phase was Thursday night. And at last I saw on Thursday afternoon, they had thousands who were not clicking. If they don't click in 3 months, presumably they lose Medicaid coverage. So we could be throwing thousands of people off who don't even know about this requirement, mm-hmm. or who lack the wherewithal to meet the what is a web click requirement more than a work requirement. Because all you got to do is say, I'm looking for work, or I volunteered at my church.
And you may already be doing that.
You
may just not
so
be able to do it technologically.
I think the lawsuit is coming, and as one Arkansan, I look forward to the lawsuit.
Well, let's say this. Let's say the lawsuit, and this is highly speculative here, let's say the lawsuit is successful. You know that that is going to require Governor Hutchinson and the Republican majorities in the state legislature to look for another avenue to keep this Medicaid expansion conservative. What would they look to do beyond a work requirement? Do you have any suggestion or thought of, I mean, don't you think politically that's what they would have to do if the yes. if it gets struck down?
To remind you, and I know you know this, there's another pending waiver request, which is to stop is to not cover up to 138% of poverty, but to cover only up to 100% of poverty and throw those people in that extreme level of poverty between 100 and 138% of poverty, it's still very poor, over into the standard health care exchanges. The federal government is worried if they give Arkansas this waiver, are all these other states going to want to do the same thing, and then Medicaid, and then messes up the entire health care system. I don't know what else they would have to do. And I thought you were going to ask, as an advocate of Medicaid expansion, who admires that the governor found a way to do it, shouldn't I be rooting for this work requirement to sustain so that we can continue to get these conservative votes to keep it afloat? Mm-hmm. Because if we lose the work requirement and we lose some legislative votes, then getting that three-fourths majority, that is possible. But I am to the point where I'm tired of just saying, do whatever you can do to get these folks to vote for it. Yeah. I'm just sort of, it's time
to embrace it.
It's time
or
to embrace
to
it.
Not embrace
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah. It is. And I'm taking that out of the equation, and I'm looking at the work requirement for what it is. And it is, I think it's a mean policy, I think. I don't think everybody who's for it is mean, but I think the policy itself is mean. And I think it also is fraught with legal peril. I think we're going to get a chance to find that out.
We will find out on that. Dr. Joe Thompson and I sat down late last week, and he actually, I want to credit him for bringing this to my attention here, because I think this gets to the philosophical debate about Medicaid right. expansion and healthcare coverage. A family of four in Arkansas qualifies for Medicaid expansion coverage if they make $36,000 a year. The median household income in Arkansas is $42,000 a year. That's not much of a gap.
No.
I mean, that's a closing gap right there. Something to kind of keep in mind.
What's
there.
The point, though?
That, well, we're going to have a philosophical discussion at some point in time of how poor do you have to be?
Your point is,
qualify for Medicaid expansion when the average or the median household income is pretty close to the number for what qualifies now for Medicaid expansion for Arkansas
works. Well, we are an overwhelmingly poor state still. I mean, we got some rich people, and we're getting jobs, and maybe the future is brighter for Arkansas. But we remain a poor state, and you get outside of Northwest Arkansas and Central Arkansas and Jonesboro, that percentage, that median income, is within the Medicaid expansion population, I'm sure. And the question is, what do you do?
Yeah.
And do you tell them, unless you get to a computer, we're going to take away your health care? That's not something I personally am willing to do.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can be found in the paper. Also, his columns, including a once-a-week online-only column, can be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics, and you can find more Arkansas-related stories and interviews at TalkBusiness.net.
The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and the 20th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series continues with the Pat Bianchi Organ Trio featuring Paul Bolenbach and Byron Landrum Saturday, July 14th at the Sunrise Guitar Stage in Fayetteville. This award-winning musician brings jazz standards to a higher level with his command of the organ. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets.
Earlier this hour, we heard Zuzanna Sitek's report about the facade that's coming down on the Fayetteville Square, a facade that had covered up a building since 1958. If history is your thing, well, the Shallon Museum of Ozark History will host the Northwest Arkansas History Resource Fair Saturday from 1 until 4:30 p.m. The public's encouraged to attend this free event and speak with representatives from over 15 museums, historical and genealogical societies, archives, and preservation groups representing the region's history. The event will offer a place for researchers to learn what resources are available and connect with people who can help with the projects. If you'd like to know more about the event, you can go to shilohmuseum.org. A listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Berryville. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. We'll leave you with music from Sad Daddy. You can find out more about them and their schedule at their Facebook page. This is their song, I Don't Care Anymore, recorded for us at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.
I don't want you back anymore. After you've been passed around all over town. No, I don't care anymore. You broke the 5-second rule, your love is cruel. I don't care anymore. And I don't think about you anymore. Not in the morning, not in the morning, all day long, not all day long anymore. Only every other second, I reckon, I don't think about you anymore. See my hand, my new life's grand, I don't think about you anymore. Expiration date. You don't want me now, and later's too late. Don't you know that later's too late anymore? Well, I gotta get some loving before I'ma get in. No, your love no good here anymore. You broke the 5-second rule. Your love is cruel. I don't care anymore. Second rule, your love is cruel and I don't care anymore.